Friends, Romans, countrymen.
Well, well, well. Take a look at what the cat has dragged in. I trust, like me, that you've all enjoyed a restful winter, but now it's time to gather and hear another missive from Gaius Julius Caesar's campaign in Gaul. As you may recall, the transcendent Caesar, I can't live with or without you, has dealt soundly with yet another impudent Gallic tribe, the nasty Nervii. He retires for the winter, but with his men continuing the good work in his name, he never really leaves. These are the words of Caesar, as conveyed by Rhiannon Evans and Matt Smith. When he was starting for Italy, Caesar sent Servius Galba
with the 12th Legion and a detachment of cavalry to the district of the Nantuates, of course, Verigri and Seduni, which reaches from the borders of the Allobroges. I feel that's a soft G. Do I get away with that? From the Lake of Geneva, heard of that place, and from the River Rhone to the summit of the Alps.
I have to say, the end of that quote, this translation made it a bit easier for you because they anglicized, Frenchified some of the names there.
Oh, right.
It's Rhodanus, usually,
okay.
In Latin,
yeah,
etc.
Do you want to give us a quick geography lesson? Where are we talking about here? Where's Servius Galba heading?
He's going for real border territory between the province, Provincia, which is, you know, around Marseille now, where we all go for our summer holidays, and I never have, but maybe. And Gallia Cisalpina, remember, is Gaul, this side of the Alps, and it's technically northern Italy. So it should be fairly sedentary territory. It should be fairly safe coming that close into Italy.
Safe enough just to send one legion into.
Yeah, and the Allobroges, they're sort of one of the most famous peoples of the province.
Mm.
Although they have been a problem in the past in that they were sort of involved in the Catiline conspiracy.
So what's the significance of Book 3 of Caesar's Gallic War, and where is our intrepid hero Caesar?
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange book because he's absent for a lot of it, which you could say is a kind of trope of epic poetry in a way, that the hero's always absent for a while. And there is to see what happens when that main hero is absent, usually bad.
Mm.
And you could say that some of what happens in Book 3 is perhaps Caesar showing us what happens when he's not in control. It is a bit strange because until this point, we've been used to seeing Caesar ride in to sort out every situation.
Mm. But this time he's giving the action to somebody else. So initially, in this case, to Servius Galba. Mm. So is it to build up those individuals as well and show Rome that the war isn't all about him?
I wouldn't read it like that.
No?
Because it's not always easy for them. Well, let's see what we think as we go through it.
Mm.
But I would argue that very broadly, it's often the Roman soldiers, the ordinary troops, that are the ones that come through if anyone does.
Okay, and what year is this book taking place in?
Well, this book is very, very strange in that it takes place over 2 years. So most of it is 56 BCE, and that's what we'd expect. So book one was 58, mm-hmm. book two was 57. This is the pattern now, but book three is going to be 56. But the initial action actually takes place at the tail end of 57.
Mm.
So it's a very long year, although it ends up being not that long a book.
It would have been longer if Caesar was directly involved.
Maybe so, yeah. Maybe so.
What was Servius Galba's mission then? What was he doing in the area? And I'm saying the area because I've obviously forgotten where he's going. Where's he going?
He's basically going to the Alps.
Okay.
So the bit between southern France now and the Alps.
Why is Servius Galba in the Alps?
Yeah, and it's a fairly prosaic reason as well. It's not to deal with a specific war. It's to open up a trade route, to stop people who are preventing that trade route from being open, but basically to clear away those who are blocking the passes through the Alps so that Caesar can now, I mean, after all, he's pacified Gaul. He needs to have easy access back and forth, and he needs to start a little more economic activity going through there. And there's obviously some people in the way. He doesn't really go into detail explaining why Galba needs to do this, but he assumes that we'll know that's what it is. And indeed, Galba gets involved in some skirmishes and is fairly successful. So it's over fairly quickly. There's nothing very glorious in all of this if you want a big battle and dramatic activity. We don't get that here.
Yeah, yeah. And again, is that down to Caesar not being present or not heavily involved?
Yeah, I'd say so. And it's not the kind of battle that he can get much drama out of, presumably. Mm. There's not much narrative. It is very brief. There's peace and there are hostages taken. But yet we would normally get more detail if Caesar was involved. The reason, presumably, that he's not involved is A, it's getting into winter season and he's supposed to go off and do his other job at the law courts, at the assizes. And B, he doesn't really think this is worthy of his attention. He can delegate this to somebody inferior.
Mm. So Galba decides to winter with the troops in the Alps, which I would have thought would be a fairly cold place to do it. But sure, why not?
I guess that's where he is. Yes. And also he can keep an eye on his recent successes from there.
Mm.
And he's been ordered to do all of this by Caesar. So even though we said Caesar was absent, Caesar's sort of there as the delegator. You go do this, and then presumably you winter right here to keep an eye on it.
Mm. In a hamlet of the Viragri, yes, okay. called Octodurus.
Yeah, which means eight hard in Latin.
Eight hard.
Yeah, octo is eight.
Yeah.
And durus means like durable, tough.
Okay, I'm sure there's a very interesting explanation for naming your village that. And now we've got a description of the location of the said hamlet. It is set in a valley with no great space of level about it and shut in all around by very lofty mountains, as the hamlet was divided in two by a river, which is an interesting location.
Yeah, I mean, if they're trading via that river, it's useful to have settlements on both sides, I suppose.
Yeah. Galba granted one part of this to the Gauls and assigned the other, which the Gauls had evacuated, to his cohorts to winter in. Which is a bit of an interesting division, but you don't want to mess with the locals.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting way of putting it. I mean, the translation is good here, but it kind of implies that they just willingly went off cap in hand.
Who, the Gauls?
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Galba threw them out so that he could have that part over the other side of the river.
He fortified the place with rampart and trench. So now we get an indication that there's a bit of subterfuge going on because the Gauls withdraw overnight. And Galba awakes to find the heights overhanging were occupied by an enormous host of Siduni and Viragri.
They haven't just gone willingly. They summed up what they know about the landscape. I mean, if anyone's been to the Alps, you know how impressive and, as it says here, overhanging some of the cliffs can be, some of the heights. And they've used that landscape to trap the Romans, effectively, to trap Galba and his troops.
So why are they doing this? What's their motive for it?
Well, they're probably rather annoyed that some of them have been thrown out of their hamlet. And they think that this also is a precursor of the future. They think their territory is all going to be taken away. They don't like the fact that their children have been taken as hostages. Caesar also tells us, this is an interesting psychological point, if he's right, who knows. They think that it's kind of an insult that such a small force has come to look after them. They think they'll be easy to defeat. They literally despicierebant, they look down on them, is what the verb says. They look down on the Romans who are weak here because there aren't very many of them. Remember, Galba's only got one legion and it's a depleted legion because he's left some of the troops elsewhere with the Nantuantes. So it's pretty sound reasoning because they've got the advantage of the territory. And they reckon there aren't many Romans, so this is the time to go for it.
It seems like they think this won't be much of a challenge to them, so they might as well.
It's actually looking bad when the next chapter starts by saying that Galba knows his fortification isn't finished and that he doesn't have much food supply. The corn supply is low.
Mm.
So at this point, as the Roman reader, you'd probably be thinking this could be a problem. The Gauls are confident. The Romans don't really have much reason to be confident. So it's quite artfully set up, I think, by Caesar, that the narrative is one of your side, if you're a Roman reader, is looking weak here, is looking vulnerable. Indeed, what Caesar leads us through is the way Galba's thinking. This is his thought process. We can assess what the Gauls think and why they think that, and now we can assess how Galba's thinking. So it's quite an interesting way of presenting the narrative, I think. The language is pretty strong. In Latin, we're told that the Romans despair of their safety, and the words are desperata salute, literally with their safety despaired of. They've got no hope for it at all. Morale is really low here, and I think this is something that's important to note as part of a narrative moment when Caesar's not there. So he can usually inspire them. There are moments where they feel very low and despondent. In book one, they were really terrified of the Germans, and Caesar could give a rousing speech and say, you know, a couple of generations ago, we defeated people like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And now he's not there to do that kind of thing.
So it sounds like they could really use him now. So they have a council of war. There are many opinions of abandoning the baggage, making a sortie, and striving to win safety by the same routes which had brought them thither.
Which is a long way around of saying, let's just run away.
Fight your way out, go back to where you came from.
However, that's not what happens. We don't get much more of the discussion, but we're told that the decision is made to stay and defend. We're not told who makes that decision.
I'm assuming Galba.
Presumably Galba. He's not put here as a decisive character, is he? It's not made clear. I don't want to harp too much on this, but I think it would be clear if it was Caesar in the picture. He's not giving that position to Galba.
So the Gauls attack Galba, and we're told in Chapter 4, the enemy, upon a signal given, charged down from all sides and hurled volleys of stones and javelins against the rampart. At first, the Roman troops repelled them gallantly, with strength unimpaired, and discharged not a missile in vain from their higher station.
So it doesn't look totally awful for the Romans. They're in a situation, we're in Chapter 4 now, where the Romans really have to jump to it, because we're told right at the beginning there that they're caught unawares. So the fact that they can get it together at all, remember their fortifications aren't finished, apparently morale is a bit low, but when it comes to it, this is their professionalism. This is Caesar really celebrating that when they have to, the Romans will stand there, they will be brave, they will challenge the enemy.
It leaves no doubt, though, that the Gauls heavily outnumber the Romans here, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And we're told that the result of this is that the Gauls can rotate their troops. So this sounds like it's going on for quite a while. The Gauls can move some people to the back and others forward and swap them around.
Yeah.
The Romans do not have that luxury. They've only got one line of troops. So again, it's a very dramatic situation where you fear for the Roman safety if you're a Roman reader. So as Caesar says here in Chapter 4, not only had a wearied man no chance of retiring from the battle, but not even a wounded man could leave the spot where he'd been posted and look after himself. So if you're wounded, there's nowhere for you to go.
Yeah.
You can't be taken away. You have to keep trying to fight. This is a pretty knife-edge situation for the Romans.
So we're told that fighting lasts for more than 6 hours, which I didn't think is a huge amount of time for something like that. But yeah, okay, I've never fought 6 hours.
I think I'd be done for in 15 minutes. But yes, I mean, some battles do go on all day. I think that's why Caesar precedes this with that information that the Romans have no relief. Presumably, if a battle goes on all day, you are doing that rotating of troops.
So we're told here that Publius Sextius Baculus, the senior centurion, whom we have mentioned as disabled by several wounds in the battle with the Nervii, and that brackets thing is actually part of the quote, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So Caesar's
giving us context.
he's being self-referential here.
Caesar's saying, hey, remember back in book 225 when this person mattered then as well? And with him, Gaius Volusianus advise making a sortie.
So they advise getting out.
A sortie means fighting your way out. And I did have to look that up, yes.
The two things that are interesting about this is that these are not senior. They're not senior management, as it were. They're not executives. They're not generals. They're not the lowest troops, but they are kind of middle management troops.
Yeah, yeah.
And that Caesar's name-checking them, which I think is quite unusual in a history text. And also that Caesar's expecting us to have read Book 2.
Yes.
Okay, so it's a kind of encouragement to do your homework. Or, yeah, he's expecting that we're reading this narrative all the way through. We're
also
not just taking one book.
Good to see that Baculus didn't die of his wounds. So, a change of fortune and the Romans slaughter attackers. Of 30,000 Gauls, over a third are killed.
Yeah, the commentators on this are very sceptical about those numbers, of whether there were 30,000 and whether 10,000 were killed. And having said that, it's very common for historians to look at ancient histories, not just Caesar, and say, oh, those numbers are impossible.
Yeah, so it doesn't say how the tides were turned, it just said it happened. Chapter 6, thus all the forces of the enemy were routed, and the Romans, stripping off the arms of their slain, retired to their own entrenched camp. This battle over, Galba declined to try the fortune too often. He remembered that there were great differences now between the purpose of his coming into winter quarters and the state of things which he had found, and he was greatly concerned by the lack of corn and supplies. So despite a victory, Galba doesn't want to push his luck or anything. He just wants to go, oh my Caesar, I can't believe we won, and go back to whence he came.
In a way that speaks well of Galba, in that he's concerned that he's got the supplies for the troops,
yes.
Something Caesar always does too. But I think that it is quite striking that we don't get very much detail of how the tide turned for the Romans. And basically, responsibility or the credit is sort of given to those two more lowly troops, to Baculus and Volusenus. They kind of advise getting out at the right time.
Mm.
The fact that they do that, without saying it, it makes it look like Galba's not entirely in charge. So I think you can read a little bit between the lines if you want to here, and the lack of detail allows for that.
So they leave for the safety of the province?
This is the real end of 57 BCE.
Okay.
You can see how this would be bad as a tacked on to the end of book two.
So as a slight coda to this, we actually know a bit more about Servius Galba post Caesar's Gallic War, which is always nice. So Servius Galba, as his name might imply, is the great-grandfather of his namesake, the Emperor Galba. And Caesar also had an affair with the man's wife.
Yeah, so because the great-grandson became emperor, albeit very briefly, because it's that year of the four emperors, so after Nero dies in 68, that we get more information about him because there's a biography by Suetonius of Galba, the emperor. In chapter 3, he says that one of Caesar's lieutenants in Gaul was the great-grandfather, but he was angered because his commander caused his defeat for the consulship. So he joined the conspiracy with Brutus and Cassius and was consequently condemned to death by the Pedian law, which is the law that was brought in to execute the conspirators.
So this guy turns against Caesar and it ends up catching up with him.
Yes. It's an interesting footnote to all of that, that he's played this part as a not quite good enough, but sort of adequate leader, I would say, here in these few chapters. And he's going to end up as Caesar's mortal enemy.
It's interesting that if Emperor Galba lasted longer, I'd wonder if he'd go, oh, you know, Julius Caesar had an affair with my great-grandmother, so Caesar's actually my great-grandfather.
Or would he have taken against him? Because of that enmity with Caesar, would he have taken against Julius Caesar rather than claiming descent from him?
Oh, but you've also got his family lineage, I suppose, one of the conspirators who killed Caesar.
Yeah, the Galba family are extremely aristocratic, but then Caesar's family is extremely aristocratic. And I guess by then, oh, this is all speculation, but being a descendant of Julius Caesar is something very worth having. Anyway, he only lasted a few months, so he never got to do that.
All right, so that's a sign-off of the first brief adventure in Book 3 of Caesar's Gallic War. Next, we're told about the campaign against the Veneti.
This is one of my favourite bits.
Yeah, okay.
It's a strange little episode.
It's very different, yeah. So we check back in with Caesar.
Yeah, we've heard this a few times, but he assumes in chapter 7 that all Gaul is at peace again.
Oh, good.
And every time he says that, we think, well, something else is going to happen, isn't it? This book's not going to be just 6 chapters long. For he says the Belgae are defeated, the Germani are driven out, and the Suduni in the Alpine region conquered, which is just what we've had with Galba there, of course.
Yes.
So it looks safe for him to leave, and he goes off, indeed, not just into Italy, as he normally does, but actually to Illyricum, which is further east, it's approximately modern Croatia, so, which is still part of his provincial remit, and he barely ever goes there. In fact, he says here that he needs to get to know that region.
Okay,
Year 3 of his proconsulship, and he still doesn't know much about it. But, of course, while he's away, really, he should never leave, because things go bad. War breaks out in Gaul. So at this point, Publius Crassus the Younger.
Yes, we've met him before.
Yeah, he is with the 7th Legion and has been wintering near the ocean, we're told, in the country of the Andes. Don't get confused with the Andes. They're a long, long way away.
So where's the Andes?
The Andes are near the modern river Loire, which in Caesar's text is called the Ligure, which is in northwest Gaul. We've been in southeast Gaul with Galba. We've gone diametrically opposite, as we'll no doubt see at some point geography in this text is not exactly the same as we might think of it in terms of orientations, but it is the other end of Gaul. And we kind of pick up on a similar theme. He's in strife with supplies. He doesn't have much to feed them with. He doesn't have much corn. So he sends out to the Gauls for supplies. This is what you do.
So he lists all the men that he's going to send, but the main focus is given to two people whose names you are going to say, because I'll just stuff them up.
The main people sent out to do this are Quintus Vellanius and Titus Silius. They go among the Veneti. Now, the Veneti live kind of the furthest out west of any of the Gauls. Mm. So that bit of modern France that sticks out into the Atlantic, modern Brittany, that's where they are, kind of on the underside of Brittany.
Yes. So we're told about the Veneti in chapter 6 that they have the most extensive authority over all the seacoast in those districts, for they have numerous ships in which it is their custom to sail to Britain, and they excel the rest in the theory and practice of navigation. So that's a big name drop there for Britain and reference to people travelling to it.
Yeah, that will become more important in the next couple of books, of course.
Yeah.
And, of course, Caesar hasn't arrived there but he doesn't have any boats. He's come by foot.
Yeah.
So they have a different means of transport. And also, he's given them mastery over this. He said that they know a lot about the theory and practice of navigation. This is a bit different because the Gauls until this point haven't really been granted much in the way of expertise.
Mm.
That these people are.
Yes, yes. He actually admires them for something for once. So Silius and Vellanius are detained so that the Veneti might get their hostages back. So this is just an opportunistic thing. You come here asking us for corn, fine. Put you in chains, throw you in a cage, and we would like our hostages back, please, which is, look, fair enough. But the other tribes in the area decide, well, that's a good idea. Yeah. Look at these Romans coming to us asking for corn. We would like our hostages back, please.
Yeah, so this is a precedent. This is clearly, from the Roman point of view, something you have to stamp out because the Isubi and the Curio Solites are doing the same. And Caesar
explains... The Curio Solites.
Yeah.
What are we going to name our tribe? What isn't taken yet? Let's go for Curio Solites. Sure.
It may well be a kind of Romanization of something that sounds quite different. Caesar gives a rationale for this. So again, he's kind of doing Gallic psychology.
Mm.
And this is a downer that he often says about the Gauls. He says that they're rash. They make these snap decisions. He says they're subita, which means sudden, and repentina consilia, which means they make decisions in a reckless way. Of course, he's annoyed because they've done something he doesn't want them to do.
Mm.
But this is something that comes up again and again. This is kind of a Gallic characteristic, according to Caesar.
Yeah.
They don't think things through.
But the Gauls justify their actions.
Oh, absolutely.
As they would, yes.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's Caesar telling us this, so he has given us that justification as well.
Mm.
The Gauls here, and it's Caesar's text, we constantly have to remind ourselves, they talk about their ancient libertas, their liberty, which is a word quite dear to the Romans in some ways. Of course, it's something they don't want their enemies to have or those they have conquered.
Mm.
So they kind of understand why the others might want it, but it's their job to not allow for that or only allow a certain amount of it, the amount of liberty which will allow the Romans to get on with the business of empire. Caesar uses quite emotive language that he puts into their mouths, that we want this liberty, and they contrast that with what they get from the Romans, which is slavery, servitus.
Mm.
You know, that's a terribly damning word to the Romans. It's something that you want to avoid as a free person.
So the Romans have picked a fight, if you want to look at it like that, with the Veneti, who are a coastal people with plenty of ships, which means that Caesar's going to have to approach this a bit differently, other than just, you know, I have 10,000 men, I'm marching them to the top of the hill, and then I'll march them down again.
Yeah, well, and Crassus is involved in this. He gets to inform Caesar of the circumstances, but Caesar gets to make the decisions in chapter 9. What does he decide to do? Let's build some ships then. So he orders ships to be built. In the translation, they are called men of war on the River Loire, so close by where we were before, which flows into the ocean, he says. So they can take them into the ocean and sail them there. And they also get rowers from the province. They draft them. And the province is an area they can trust.
So it seems to be a rather quick process to build a man of war ship.
Yeah.
Or multiple ships, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. in Latin, they're called naves longas, long ships. Mm. And it is very matter of fact, isn't it?
Yeah.
But then we've seen that before when, you know, you've got to build a bridge. Caesar is one of the places I think we get this idea from, that the Romans just do things quickly.
Mm.
They're very efficient. And look, apparently they did build these ships because they can use them against the Veneti and it hasn't taken them a long time. And, you know, I guess there was no bureaucracy for Caesar. He just put out the order and it got done. There was no paperwork involved.
So the Veneti perceived the magnitude of their offence. And that's a lovely term. I think is the Latin translation something along the lines of they realised how much shit they were in.
Well, the cognito Caesaris I'd went to, the arrival of Caesar was recognised. Is that the part? Oh, they understood at the very same time what a great act they'd committed.
Yeah.
Right.
So they realised how much shit they were in.
Kind of against themselves, actually, in say against themselves. So, yeah, your colloquial translation is somewhat accurate.
So they began to prepare for war on a corresponding scale. So we also are going to build ships.
They've already got ships,
but they build more ships. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they believed the Romans would be ill-equipped and unfamiliar with the terrain. Fair enough.
Yeah. And they're right, as it turns out, certainly at first. I guess one of the themes of this book so far are who's got the most experience.
So Caesar now decides this is a situation that he needs to be part of, so he begins to rush to join Crassus.
Yes. And this is kind of an interesting point because we know other things are going on. So it's what Caesar leaves out here. He's in northern Italy in a place called Lucca at a conference extending
the triumvirate,
the first triumvirate,
yeah,
with Pompey and Crassus the Elder,
yes,
as you're now calling him, I believe. That doesn't get mentioned at all. It's irrelevant to the Gallic War.
Mm.
Something we'll see is events that happen outside of the province of Gaul rarely intrude. And this is quite a marked instance of that.
Yeah.
Because it's something really important for Caesar's position, but it's not something that he's going to mention, not even in an offhand way. And something that it does is that it allows him to extend his proconsulship, so to be in charge of Gaul for another 5 years. So it does have a direct effect on what's going on in Gaul or his position in it, because we should always remember that Caesar's in a very unusual position here. Normally you get to be proconsul for a year.
Mm.
He's got a much longer time and he's got that term extended now.
So we now get a list of tribes who are going to take this opportunity to join the Veneti, and I assume that they have ships as well.
Mm-hmm.
The Orzismi, the Lexavi, the Namnetes. Rhiannon, do you want to read out this list of tribes?
Do you really want the list? Okay. The Orzimisi, the Lexavi, the Namnetes, the Ambilati, the Marini, the Diablintes, and the Menapii. And they also get to fetch auxiliaries from Britain, which, as Caesar says, lies opposite those regions.
Mm.
This is dependent upon the Roman view of orientation of that region. Caesar's not the only one who makes this mistake. Most ancient geographers put Britain not against what we would think of as the north coast of France now, so ancient Gaul, but sort of lying opposite to both the north and the west coast, so more poking out into the Atlantic.
Yeah.
So pointing northwest, so that it gets to face against both of Gaul's coastlines. It's an orientation that's typical of ancient geographers, and so it's no surprise that Caesar makes what we would think of as a mistake.
Mm.
The important point for us, I guess, is that Britain's not that far away, and it's got brought up again here as a region that's giving extra help to the Gauls.
So Caesar's going to have to go and deal with them at some point.
He will definitely be going off to Britain to deter this kind of activity.
So he justifies going to war.
Yeah, it's this idea of the just war, the bellum justum. And his reasoning is his men have been taken,
mm-hmm,
which is true. The Gauls revolted after having surrendered.
The Gauls are revolting, yes.
Which is against the rules of war, I guess. And it's a conspiracy that involves so many states. You can only really call it a conspiracy if you believe you have the right to rule there already, I suppose. But that is the way that Caesar phrases it.
Mm.
He makes it sound like a difficult campaign. It's a tough ask, but Caesar has to do it.
Mm.
He needs to put these people down and put them back in their place. And one thing he's acting to prevent is Gallic unity, because you've got the Veneti starting something off and then other peoples joining them. And Gallic unity is another theme of Caesar, that very often they're disunited. There's always infighting going on.
But that always works out to your advantage if you're invading their place.
It's kind of something that Caesar wants to encourage in a way.
Yeah. So he sends Labienus to Treveri, who are near the Rhine. Crassus goes to Aquitania to stop auxiliaries coming to help the Gauls, and Sabinus goes to Vinelli, Curia Soltes, and Lex Sovi. So he's telling his troops to go to different places and disrupt the tribes from uniting.
Yeah, yeah. And then they're kind of dispersed in all different directions over Gaul.
Yeah.
Sabinus is the one who's staying local.
So now we get some detail about the Veneti tactics and how they are in naval warfare. It's a good bit of sociological observation here from Caesar.
Mm. Yeah, basically, it's very hard to trap them anywhere. It's hard to take their strongholds because they have this means of making themselves unattainable, ungrabbable, as it were. This is in chapter 12 now. Their strongholds were set at the end of tongues and promontories so as to allow no approach on foot when the tide had rushed in from the sea, which regularly happens every 12 hours, nor in ships, because when the tide ebbed again, the ships would be damaged in shoal water. What he's describing here is causeways that appear and disappear. And the Veneti know how to use this to their advantage. So they've got their strongholds at the edge of this, and they know about what the water does. They know its regular habits, as it were. But it makes it very difficult for Caesar's ships to operate because it's so shallow. And when they get attacked, they've just got their ships there, the Veneti, and they just get on their ships with supplies and go to the nearest town.
You're given the impression that they really know the coastline well enough to use it to their advantage and that their ships are suited for the area, and the Romans aren't.
Yeah, and the Caesar says that. He says that they can just come forward to their strongholds and then run away again throughout most of the summer, he says. Mm. We're already at summer now, and he makes it sound like it goes on for months, that they can just go out to the open sea if they need to. He basically describes them as, I think of it as amphibious. They can take advantage of their coastal environment, and they feel secure around the rocks because they've got these ships with keels that are flatter.
Mm.
So in other words, they can go into shallower water, and their sails are made of flax, of linen. Their ships are made of oak. Caesar says they're stoutly built, so you can't really ram them.
Mm-hmm.
Because of their height, it's not easy to hurl weapons against them, or grapnels, as he says, to grab them. The Roman ships are faster, but the Veneti ships are more maneuverable. He also tells us they can put up with storms more easily. So that implies that his ships are suffering when there are storms.
Yeah.
But because the Veneti ships are smaller, they can, as he says, rest in shoals more safely with no fear of rocks or crags.
So if you're trying to fight an enemy who's better equipped and knows the environment a lot better than you, what does that leave the Romans if they can't catch them or, you know, ram them or anything like that?
For a while, it sort of looks like stalemate. So Caesar starts taking some of their towns, but he realizes there's really no point in it because the Gauls can just retreat to their ships and they're well supplied.
Mm-hmm.
It's this point where he can't get any closer to them. And they've got 220 ships, he tells us.
Yeah.
14 of them fully prepared and provided with every kind of equipment, which sailed out of harbor and took station opposite ours. And then all of a sudden it changes. And it changes because of nobody who's named in particular, but our men, the word in Latin nostri that he uses, to show that Roman troops are really ingenious. And in the end, it's Roman ingenuity that wins out here.
Oh, so this isn't even Crassus the Younger doing this. It's just...
He doesn't name anybody who does it. It's just our men. One device our men had prepared to great advantage, and that is a sharp-pointed hook let in and fastened to long poles in shape not unlike siege hooks. And what they can do is cut down the Gauls' big, heavy flaxen sails with this.
Yeah, they fall to the deck and chaos ensues.
Yeah, indeed, they can't sail away.
Yeah.
So you could say Roman technology. It's pretty basic technology, I suppose.
It's a hook on a stick.
Yeah. But it's sort of adaptability. Let's adapt to the situation where these people have the better of us.
Mm.
And very much the credit is given to our men, Nostri, not any particular commander. So that's why I say Caesar's very keen to recognize the ordinary troops here.
Yes.
Not perhaps solely from a democratic urge, but to give more credit to them than other commanders, perhaps.
And Caesar actually puts in an appearance here for the first time in the book. He's watching on a nearby hill.
He is, yeah. Yeah, and he's watching it like it's a scene playing out beneath him. He's watching from above, which he says makes it all the sweeter for the troops, the fact that their commander is looking on. And it comes down now to more comfortable ground for Caesar, where he says the rest of the conflict was a question of courage, in which our troops easily had the advantage. The more so because the engagement took place in sight of Caesar and of the whole army, so that no exploit a little more gallant than the rest could escape notice. It's worth being brave when Caesar's watching.
Ah, yes. So the Veneti, they realise what's going on and they try to flee. There is no wind, so the ships can't move. Mm. Also hard when you do not have sails. This circumstance was in the highest degree fortunate for the settlement of the business.
it's quite a neutral way of putting it, isn't it? Yes. We could finish them off, yeah. Basically. Hmm.
For our troops pursued and boarded the vessels one by one, with the result that of all the number, very few, when the night came on, reached the land. The battle, indeed, lasted from about the fourth hour to sunset. Based on that description, can we tell what time of day it was?
We can't tell exactly, but we have a reasonably good idea. It depends. If we knew exactly the date of the battle, then we could calculate the time.
We know already that it's continuing into summer here, so we're giving an indication of the time of the year.
It also depends on the latitude, because sunset is different according to your latitude.
Yeah.
Okay. So the translator of the Oxford version of this text, the Gallic War, who's called Caroline Hammond, she suggests that this is late August, which makes sense because in Book 3, in Chapter 12, Caesar had talked about actions which had happened for the great part of the summer. The Veneti had been carrying on with this for the great part of the summer, which means probably late summer. And at that time of year, in late summer, each hour lasts 1 hour and 9 minutes. The duration of the Roman hour changes according to the time of year.
Okay.
So it's not a consistent period of time, which makes things awkward. If that's right, and I think that's reasonable enough that it's late August here, the fourth hour would be around 10 a.m. And this battle is lasting until sunset, which would be around 9 p.m.
So they're fighting most of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, 11 or even 12 hours.
Okay. So does that mean that earlier on 6 hours isn't 6 hours as well?
Not necessarily our version of 6 hours. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It would be slightly longer than that because the day is longer. Mm. So the hour stretches out for a longer period of time.
So poor Caesar's on top of a hill watching all this happen.
Oh, terrible. So much harder than fighting.
He's got the very hard job there. Maybe that's why he was keeping such good track of time.
Well, we know from elsewhere that he put the calendar right. So he kind of is in charge of time.
This engagement brings about the end of the Veneti, and we're told that all fighting men are essentially wiped out here. So Caesar, who has shown mercy in the past, but now it doesn't seem like he's in that sort of mood in 16, decided that their punishment must be more severe in order that the privilege of deputies might be more carefully preserved by the natives in the future. So don't take my men hostages to try and get your hostages back.
Exactly. So he's definitely trying to make a point here. He's using them as an example.
Yes. So he therefore put the whole of their senate to the sword and sold the rest of the men as slaves.
And selling into slavery was not uncommon. So all that talk earlier about hating slavery, the Gauls get to say that, results in them actually being slaves. There's a kind of irony here.
Yeah.
And it's very brief and offhand. In English, it always takes a few more words to say it, but killing the Senate and selling the rest of the men into slavery is, you know, it's done in, I think it's 7 words in Latin. Omni senatio necato, all of the Senate was killed. Mm-hmm. That's 3 words. Reliquo sub corona vendidit, he sold the left literally under the wreath because slaves at auction were decked in a wreath. Those two actions, the killing and the enslavement, take very few words in Latin.
And just for the sake of a certain good-looking Latin newsreader,
Accordingly, they surrendered themselves and all they had to Caesar. He decided that their punishment must be more severe in order that the privilege of deputies might be more carefully preserved by the natives for the future. He therefore put the whole of the Senate,
to the sword and sold the rest of the men as slaves. Let this be a lesson to all of us. Caesar is merciful, but you can push the friendship a tad too much. That's it today for the great word from Caesar. Until next time, off you go. Ave. Ave.